Welcome to Soundboard, your source for news, culture, and community issues in Central Virginia. My name's Eliza Wilson, and later in the show, you'll be hearing from Nathan Moore. Soundboard airs every Saturday at 6 a.m. on WTJU 91.1 FM, and also podcasting as part of the TEEJ FM network. That's TEEJ.FM. Tune in, subscribe, and find out what's happening in your community and around your state. Later in the show, we'll hear from Richmond-based journalist Peter Galaska, plus an interview with Professor of Religious Studies Jelaine Smith on Liberation and Freedom Days. But right now, we're joined here in the studio by Giles Morris, the executive director at Charlottesville Tomorrow, Elliot Robinson, the news editor at Charlottesville Tomorrow, as well as Emily Hayes, a news writer at Charlottesville Tomorrow. Emily, can you take us through the updates on the Star Hill Small Area Plan and the New Hill Development Corporation's involvement in the upcoming developments?
Yeah, so New Hill Development Corporation is a Charlottesville-based nonprofit that started about a little less than a year ago. And they have city funding to develop this small area plan for Star Hill, which is near West Main Street and Preston Avenue. It's sort of in between those two. And it encompasses some of the area that used to be Vinegar Hill. So New Hill's focus is expanding and supporting Charlottesville's African-American middle class. So they are literally the new Vinegar Hill. That's how the idea came about. So they're early in the stages of their small area plan, and they're asking community members to come forward to be the engagers, to put out flyers, to talk to people, to help make the community engagement really feel trusted.
Thanks for giving us that lowdown, Emily. And now let's turn to Elliot. Can you tell us a little bit about the race and zoning forum that happened at the Jefferson School last Friday?
Yes, it was a fascinating conversation. There was standing room audience there, and the discussion had several people talking about the race and zoning issues, and it was effectively an in-person presentation of a lot of conversations that have been occurring on Twitter over the past days, months, and years. And a lot of things that were touched on were the history of zoning in the city and how a lot of it had a racial component, and for a fact that Charlottesville brought in effectively the architect of racial covenants and redlining from Missouri to do the zoning in the city itself to exclude people from parts of the city like Fry Spring and the northern parts of the Martha Jefferson neighborhood. There was also a presentation on effectively the elephant in the room of UVA's effect on housing issues in the city, and it concluded with a call to action to get people to come to city council meetings to bring those fresh faces and voices to those conversations.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking a lot about zoning and new housing developments in Charlottesville this week. And Emily, there's something called the Section 3 program. Can you touch a little bit upon that?
Yeah, so the key idea with Section 3 is when you redevelop public housing, a lot of money is coming through to do the construction and design and all of this. And what if some of that money goes directly into residents' pockets, into low-income neighbors' pockets, so it would benefit the larger neighborhood as well? This was a program that was started by the U.S. Housing and Urban Development Department. And so what is happening locally is they're just bringing their policy more in line with that program to be able to build. They haven't gotten to the program stage yet. They've approved the policy, but they have also put some money in their budget for a Section 3 coordinator who could help apply the program in creative ways to get paid training, employment, resident-owned businesses to be contracted.
And Giles, will you speak a little bit on the issue of transparency in conjunction with new public housing development?
Yeah, well, I think all of these issues are contextualized in this larger conversation about race and equity in town, and that we're in this moment where we're moving from reconciliation towards more substantive conversations about how you move forward with policies and plans that actually create change and change the power dynamics and change people's opportunities and change the way we as a community see ourselves. I think those plans are really TBD. And you're seeing a lot of various little initiatives start to pop up, but there's some big things happening. I mean, we went from a discussion around a $50 million bond referendum to pay for the redevelopment of our public housing to a public-private partnership where the biggest private developer in town is now the developer of public housing. Does the community know that? I mean, is there a community-wide discussion about how we're shaping our future and how these initiatives are lining up with each other? So you see in the Star Hill, New Hill small area plan idea, what are the policy pieces that are going to shape that neighborhood? And then we're moving forward with, you know, programs like Section 3, which are designed to go from just, you know, let's put people in housing to how do we move them out of the situation that keeps them in public housing in terms of local hiring practices, in terms of putting money back into the community, in terms of connecting them to the larger structures in the community that would allow them mobility. And I just think this is a really, really interesting time because the city is in its budgeting process, and it's a great time for the community to be very tuned in to these conversations because one of the real front lines of the race equity conversation in Charlottesville is housing and neighborhood identity with respect to housing.
And Elliot, is there anything else you'd like to bring up from the forum last Friday? Did they talk about any of these new development initiatives like New Hill?
A lot of it is that the city is working on its comprehensive plan. It was more putting these things in the context of it's easy to fall into this neighborhood was zoned R1, the single family residential, because it's always been that way, or that seems like a reasonable practice. And it was with this background of what happened in the 40s and 50s and 60s of, well, this was based on excluding people of color in this neighborhood. And that's what has contributed in part to our affordable housing issue, is that it's a small city. These areas were zoned in a way that apartments couldn't get built, or duplexes, or smaller homes, because they had to be on lots of a certain size. So when the city gets to that hard point where we said that we're landlocked, we need to do something about it, we need to make things more dense, that when someone comes back and says, no, we shouldn't do that because I like how my neighborhood looks, is like, well, it looks that way because it was trying to keep people out, and we're trying to bring people back in so we don't have people making minimum wage that can't afford to live in Charlottesville and they're eating up their half of their paycheck commuting in from some of the outlying counties to work this job.
Yeah. But I guess one of the things I always wonder about these conversations, and I would love it if you guys weighed in on like how that Twitter conversation developed into a public program, you know, because that's been really interesting to watch how some key protagonists in these conversations are developing this body of knowledge around this stuff. But it's also kind of like, sometimes I'm like, aren't we overly nerding out about the fact that this is a racist, segregated town, and we all know that, and that the north side of town was all white and didn't allow African Americans in it? I mean, how much more of a deep dive into the code do we do? Because I think we have, as a community, some consensus that we don't want to do that anymore. What we do going forward has a lot to do with how you change the economics, how you change the affordability in neighborhoods, how do you change, frankly, the neighborhood identities in neighborhoods that make people want to live in a place, make people have opportunities in a place. And I think that's the piece of the discussion I don't think we're at yet as a community.
Well, I think some of what I talked about today is a little bit related to that. New Hill Development Corporation is really focused on that cultural side as well as that business side of creating an African-American middle class. Like I said, the Section 3 program is also about economic changes as well. And so I think those are some initiatives that are pushing that conversation.
I feel that we're moving towards, in a way, a unified theory where all of these issues are coming together, that we need affordable housing, but we also need to have these conversations about the living wage. So once we get to that point of where to start exactly, I guess it's almost like a chicken or the egg situation of, do we build affordable housing first, or do we raise people's wages first? That these two conversations need to really mesh together, and I think that the city's upcoming changes to its comprehensive plan and finally bringing UVA into this conversation is going to force that reconciliation.
Well, thank you guys for coming in and giving us the lowdown this week.
All right, thank you. For more information on our reporting, please visit SeavilleTomorrow.org.
Thank you for having us.
Once again, that was Giles Morris, the executive director of Charlottesville Tomorrow, Elliot Robinson, the news editor of Charlotte Tomorrow, and Emily Hayes, a news writer at Charlottesville Tomorrow. You're listening to Soundboard here on WTJU 91.1 FM and the TEEJ FM network, TEEJ.FM. WTJU and TEEJ FM are both a service of the University of Virginia. Opinions expressed on the show are, of course, just that, opinions, not the positions of the University of Virginia.
Well, here in Virginia, lawmakers are in session for less than 2 months in odd-numbered years. But as always, there's a fire hose of legislation to follow and talk about. To help us make sense of all this, we turn now to our regular correspondent on state news and politics, Peter Galaska. He's a journalist based in the Richmond area. Well, Peter, the Virginia General Assembly just wrapped up its 2019 session. So let's go through a little post-mortem appraisal of what happened at the General Assembly this year.
Well, I've looked at this as preparing it, and I've selected 6 points. I'm going to list them if it's okay with you.
Yeah, we'll do the like Gatling gun version here.
Yeah, like the plus and minus, plus and minus, plus and minus, okay?
All right.
On the first plus side, we've got coal ash, which means was passed, and that means that that one quarter of the 27 million cubic yards of coal ash at Dominion's coal-fired generating stations has to be dug up and removed to inland storage facilities. This is because Dominion wanted to just simply dewater their pits and just sort of put a tarp over them, which in a remarkable display of bipartisan environmentalism, key Republicans and Democrats said no. There's a huge public outcry about this about 2 or 3 years ago. And despite Dominion's very vigorous public relations efforts, the General Assembly, in a rare, rare example, brought them to heel. So now they're going to have to dig up at least some of it. It doesn't answer some questions, though, but it's a real step.
Yeah, and like what to do with the pollution that's already out there in the groundwater.
Yeah, I don't know what they could do about that.
Yeah. But, yeah. All right, next up on the list.
Okay, the negative. ERA. ERA of Virginia had become the 38th state to approve the ERA from the early 70s.
And ERA is the Equal Rights Amendment.
Equal Rights Amendment, right, I'm sorry. That it would have been ratified and law of the land throughout the United States. And ERA went through, and this has happened like five times before. It passed at the Senate, but then it went to a certain death in a House committee that's controlled by Republicans.
And I don't get why in 2019 even Republican committees can be opposed to a basic statement of equal rights based on gender.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the thing is that there are all kinds of arguments pro and con about it. I mean, you know, for one thing, a lot of the pro-ERA people say, wait a second, women should have rights. The Republicans come back, not Republicans, but conservatives and anti-ERA people say it would make women susceptible to the draft. It would force unisex bathrooms and all kinds of stuff, which, you know, whatever.
All right, next up on our list.
Okay, plus redistricting. For years, Virginia had the General Assembly set up redistricting. I think it comes like every 10 years, and whoever is in majority at the time gets to pretty much decide. Well, when both sides do it, they gerrymander. The Democrats have done it for years, and so have the Republicans. It's just that at least two cases in the past several years, Republican-led gerrymandering efforts have led to court decisions later to undo them because they're thought that they disenfranchise African-American voters. So the solution is to take it sort of out of their hands and give it to an independent redistricting commission, which they did. There is now going to be a 16-member commission. The only issue that bugs me a little bit is that the General Assembly will still get to pick a number of those people.
So how much does that insulate that commission from partisanship?
Exactly. I think it's like 4 each, and then there's going to be a citizen panel and then others.
All right. So then, what's the next negative?
The next negative is medical bills. Let's just say that you're in an accident, a car wreck, and you're taken to an emergency room somewhere far from your home, and you display your insurance card, and you go through the treatment, and you're okay after a while. And then a few months later, you get a bill for $10,000. And that could be because someone, without checking with your with you or your insurance, added on services that were not covered by your plan, you're out of network. And the bill would have done away with this, or at least regulated it. And it was stalled in the House Appropriations Committee, so that's not happening.
So we can still get surprise bills of thousands of dollars after an ER visit.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Anything else?
A couple things. Another positive was taxes. The state had to adjust its tax plan to meet federal requirements after President Trump's issues last year with new law. So it means that according to this, individuals could get $100 refunds and couples $220. So we shall see.
All right. Although that one had a little bit of contention to it because some of those funds could have been used to shore up low-income tax credits.
Exactly. I mean, there are a lot of aspects to it, but at least it's some movement, and that's, you know, given the divisiveness in the General Assembly, it's probably a step forward. And the last one is license suspensions. I mean, the state law says that if you have been in court and you haven't paid your fines or court costs, you could have your driver's license suspended. And that seems to be kind of counterproductive because if you need money to pay your fines and if you need a car to get to your job, you know, how can you do that? It just makes the burden worse on you, and it means that the courts aren't going to get their money anyway. So the Senate passed a bill to kill that, but it was stalled in a GOP-led House subcommittee.
And that one's one where it really just seems kind of punitive. I mean, it's like
punishing
poor people.
It's kind of like you're almost mixing apples and oranges because suppose your court costs involve some other non-related issue that's not related to traffic or cars or something like that. It could be anything. You know, it could be a judgment because you were late in paying your apartment rent. Who knows?
Well, Peter, that was a pretty good, you managed to take the fire hose of information and bills from the assembly, and I think we just sort of channeled that into a nice little stream.
Yeah.
Want to talk about one more thing that lawmakers in Richmond want. You know, all these, the main floor sessions in Richmond have been live video streamed for a few years now, but all those subcommittees, the ones that you were just talking about, where they kill bills and things just kind of go to die, we don't know what's said in those subcommittees. We don't know how or who's saying it, and it's not video recorded. It's not video streamed. There's some effort afoot to change that. Can you take me through some of what's going on there?
Yeah, apparently a group of lawmakers, bipartisan, led by a Democrat, Mark Levin of Alexandria, and Amanda Chase, who was a Republican of Chesterfield, they're part of the Virginia Transparency Caucus. And what they want to do is have a lot of subcommittee hearings televised. For years, Virginia has been, the General Assembly has been one of the least transparent legislatures in the country by a number of standards. And this would, you know, put some spotlights on there. And it's so sad because the real power in Virginia in terms of legislative power is really in the subcommittees because, they, as you just seen from the list we went through, you know, you can kill a lot of laws just by letting them die on the vine or just having a vote, even though that majority of your House, Senate, or the House of Delegates really wants something. A small group of people can really still kill it, and they can do so in the dark. So this it's gotten a lot of support. This idea of expanding, you know, televised coverage has gotten a lot of support, but we'll see what happens.
Well, Peter, in our last minute or so, I want to talk about and check in on the scandals around race issues and otherwise in the executive, the governor, lieutenant governor, and now evidently the First Lady of Virginia has a little...
Yeah, as you know, like Governor Ralph Northam got in trouble because he may or may not have been in some medical school yearbook showing him as either in blackface or as a Klans person, and Mark Herring admitted being blackface too. And just recently, Pam Northam, the governor's wife, was giving school children a tour of the executive mansion, and she was talking about, she handed out balls of cotton to them and said, you know, just to remind you of how hard it was with slavery, and she happened to hand some balls of cotton to two African-American girls who were kind of upset about it. And I don't know what to think of this. You know, she says that she didn't do anything untoward. It was just that, you know, apparently she's a teacher and she uses, you know, hands-on methods to teach things. But one girl's mother wrote a letter saying, wait a minute, I mean, this is just not appropriate, especially when you hand it to an African-American child saying, you know, this is your place. And it's all a matter of atmospherics and nuance. But, you know, coming after the other blackface issues, it's been kind of a sour note.
All right, Peter, thanks so much.
Sure.
Peter Galaska is a journalist based in the Richmond area.
You're listening to Soundboard here on WTJU 91.1 FM and the TEEJ FM network, TEEJ.FM. WTJU is supported by the Southern Environmental Law Center, celebrating 30 years of protecting the South's environment and the people who depend on it for health and well-being. Power of the Law, Southern Environmental Law Center.
Well, there's a local celebration in Charlottesville this weekend. It's Liberation and Freedom Days. It commemorates the beginnings of emancipation for some 14,000 enslaved residents of Albemarle County and the city of Charlottesville back in 1865. Here with us in the studio to tell us more about it is Professor of Religious Studies Jelaine Schmidt. Well, Jelaine, Liberation and Freedom Days is kind of like now, this weekend, here in Charlottesville and Albemarle County. What is going on with some of the events going on here?
Yeah, well, already last night at the Jefferson Theater on the downtown mall, there was a community blues and jazz performance to kind of kick off the events that are going on to celebrate these days. And then on Saturday at 9 in the morning, we're going to be meeting down at Court Square downtown and have a walking tour of the downtown area that kind of recounts the history of freedmen and their descendants. And then the big culmination is Sunday afternoon at 3 p.m. at the UVA Rotunda. There'll be a service there of remembrance and then some refreshments and a blessing ceremony at the future site of the Monument for Enslaved Laborers.
Mm-hmm. Is this a bit like a Juneteenth, but our own local version?
Yeah, you could say so. I mean, this is commemorating when... In our local area, when slaves began the process of being freed, what happened was that out in Waynesboro, Generals Custer and Sheridan overwhelmed General Early of Early'sville fame, and then marched on toward Charlottesville. And as they passed by plantations in Albemarle County, the slaves kind of filed in behind them. It was really muddy. According to the accounts from Union soldiers' diaries, the mud reached up to the knees of the horses and the hubs of the wagon wheels. They had to be abandoned en route. But still, the Union soldiers trudged on with emancipated slaves behind them, came into Charlottesville. They went to the site of the current-day UVA Chapel, and they, where the mayor and the rector of the university were literally waving the white flag.
Wow.
Yes, right, yeah. And so this is important because kind of the standard or conventional narrative in Charlottesville for so long was that, well, Charlottesville and the university were spared, thank goodness, and that was kind of the end of the story. And what we've drawn attention to in the past 3 years since city council voted to establish this commemoration is that actually more than half of the population at the time of the Civil War was enslaved. So 52% or some 14,000 individuals were enslaved. And so rather the focus of the attention about Civil War history should be on these momentous days of March the 3rd and the days following when Union soldiers arrived and 14,000 enslaved people started to be freed. I mean, like, who wouldn't want to celebrate freedom? This is something that's worthy of marking. And so, yeah, it is our kind of local day of commemoration that we have. This was about a month before Lee formally surrendered to Grant at Appomattox, but liberation came a little bit earlier here mm-hmm. than it did to other places.
What did liberation mean in those early days, months, even years for the formerly enslaved people?
Yeah, well, it came in fits and starts. I mean, even here in Charlottesville, General Sheridan was not all too pleased to have these thousands of enslaved people who were, of course, taking their chance to escape, and filing in behind Union lines. We'll hear about that on Saturday morning at the Jefferson School. There'll be presentations by some local researchers here that recount exactly that, what happened to enslaved people and recently emancipated people. But we know, there was already a very small free community of free blacks here in Charlottesville, some of whom were descended from Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson, right? And then that population increased after emancipation. So there was this small nucleus of you know, African-American folks who were very involved in local politics. Some of them became delegates, you know, in the Republican Party, others, you know, in the House of Delegates, making decisions about what direction the Commonwealth of Virginia would go in. And one of the biggest victories of the Reconstruction government at that time was the establishment of public schools in Virginia. We owe our, in the South here, the establishment of public schools largely to these Reconstruction governments. Now, Reconstruction got overthrown, you know, in 1877. But the system of public schools persisted, although, of course, a lot of inequities in funding. Yeah. But that's, you know, part of what took place was these kind of fits and starts, becoming involved in civic life, even, you know, elected office, then being pushed back, you know, during Jim Crow and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, part of that narrative about Charlottesville and Civil War, I think, is that I've heard for sure is that there's not been a lot of fighting, not a lot of battles around here.
Right.
But the social forces you're talking about, the same issues around slavery and emancipation and who has power, very much part of the story. How is the city and the university, how are they doing today, sort of thinking through these things and remembering them and applying them to what we do?
Yeah. Well, there's just been a kind of wholesale rethinking, you know, in the past couple, three decades, I would say, here in our area at places of public history, such as the American Civil War Museum, which now has a black woman as its director, Montpelier, Monticello, you know, and certainly the university. We've just been rethinking the legacy of enslaved peoples, you know, in each of these institutions, and much more of an emphasis upon public history, upon social history, that is looking at what was actually the history of the majority of people, you know, that had been ignored for so long. At the University of Virginia, this has taken the form of setting up an official president's commission on slavery at the university, which is now the official president's commission on, in the age of segregation, you know, looking at the segregation history of the university. You know, in the city of Charlottesville, of course, we had in 2016 our own process of the Blue Ribbon Commission on Race, Memorials, and Public Spaces, which was, you know, a 6 or 8 month period of public hearings every couple of weeks to discuss the status of our how we memorialize events from our past in our public spaces, specifically with respect to Confederate statues. We all know what happened with that, that, you know, city council voted to, you know, to get rid of the Lee statue and then the Summer of Hate, you know, in 2017, and the you know, literal street battles over memory. So part of what's happened here in the area with these various institutions that I just mentioned, you know, President's Homes, the university, the Civil War Museum in Richmond, certainly the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center, is this recalibrating of how memory gets presented, you know, in public programming and in educating the public.
Mm-hmm. Well, the programming for this weekend, Liberation and Freedom Days, what do you hope folks get out of it?
Yeah, I think, you know, I can never overemphasize, it seems that, the fact that over half of the local population was enslaved at the time of the Civil War. So I always say, I'm not being politically correct, I'm being demographically correct and historically correct, you know, and we all are, you know, in presenting this history and, in you know, kind of remembering this struggle. So to kind of, you know, emphasize, you know, and keep teaching the public about our collective history of struggle, which is a legacy of all of us that we all can learn from, that we all need to learn from.
Well, and the events again on the 2nd and 3rd, Saturday morning?
Saturday morning at 9 a.m. There'll be a walking tour downtown starting at Court Square at 10:30 Saturday afternoon at the Jefferson School. There'll be refreshments and presentations on local history at the time of the Civil War. And then Sunday afternoon at 3 p.m., there'll be a service at the UVA Rotunda followed by a blessing ceremony at the site of the future memorial for enslaved laborers.
Jalene, thanks for coming in.
Sure. Thanks a lot, Nathan.
Jalene Schmidt is a professor of religious studies at the University of Virginia.
Well, that does it for this week's edition of Soundboard, your source for news, culture, and community issues in Central Virginia. My name's Eliza Wilson. Our theme song is Kioja Beat by Morwenna Laszlo and Jay Pun. This is Soundboard. Catch us at WTJU.net or on our podcast home at TEEJ.FM. That's TEEJ.FM. Have a great week.